So we'll begin with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, today is Saturday, September 7th, 2013. Okay, good morning, everybody. Very beautiful autumn morning today, right? Suddenly, the last weekend, it seemed to be quite hot and humid. And suddenly, the temperature just dropped. Even in the early morning, it seems almost like December. Okay, so today we are advancing further in the middle length discourses to sutta number 105. This is the discourse to Sunakata. Now we've already met this monk named Sunakata quite a long time ago in a study of the middle length discourses. He appears in sutta number 12, where it's reported of the Sunakata that he had left the monk's life. This is on page 164. Not only did he leave the monk's life, but he even came to reject the Buddha and his teaching, and then he would go about in the assembly at Vaisali. Vaisali was a large city in the Vajjayan Republic. And the people who inhabited Vaisali and the surrounding area were called Lichavis. And so he would go around in the assembly in Vaisali, and he would actually denounce the Buddha on the ground that he says that the Buddha doesn't have any hasn't attained any superhuman states, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. And he says that the Dhamma or teaching taught by the Buddha is purely a product of reasoning. And then he says, as though it's a sort of defect in the teaching, that it only leads to the complete destruction of suffering, but not to supernormal powers. Okay, then there's another sutta which gives a little bit of the background to Sunakata's leaving rejection of the Buddha and his teaching. Another sutta that occurs in the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses, I think it's sutta number 24. Patika Sutta. Sutta number 24, where in my view, if there's any passage in the canon that comes close to being what we would call slapstick is that the expression, slapstick comedy? It would be this passage. At the time, Sunakata is the attendant, the personal attendant of the Buddha. And as the Buddha, together with Sunakata, they're walking into the town to go on alms round, and they pass one ascetic who's observing what is called the dog's practice asceticism. That is, he's going around on his hands and feet, or arms and legs, like a dog, completely naked. And he's wagging his behind like he's wagging a tail. And he's refusing to eat any kind of food that people formally offer to him. But he'll only eat food that's been thrown away onto the ground. And so as they go passing this ascetic, Sunakata says to the Buddha, he must be an arahant. For that's the way arahants behave. And the Buddha says to him, Sunakata, you have no idea about the way, about what an arahant really is and about the way arahants behave. Then Sunakata gets angry and he says, is the Blessed One denying others their arahantship? Then the Buddha says to Sunakata, mark my word, in seven days from now, this dog ascetic is going to die from indigestion. And he will be reborn as a particular kind of asura, but the lowest kind of asura. Okay, he'll die from indigestion, and then he will be reborn as this lowest kind of asura. It's a being in the Titan world. And after he dies, they're going to throw his body in the charnel ground. Then the Buddha says to Sunakata, if you have any doubt about this, when they throw his body in the charnel ground, you go there, you tap on his body three times, and then he'll regain consciousness, and then you can question him about this. And Sunakata, excuse me, he wants the Buddha to be wrong about this. And so when they go back to the monastery, he sort of sneaks away from the Buddha and he goes to this dog duty ascetic and he says, be very careful about what you eat. Somehow I heard a prediction that if you're not careful about what you eat, you're going to get indigestion and you might even die from that. Okay, so the dog ascetic is very careful about what he eats, but still, when the seventh day comes, he gets indigestion and dies. Okay, so then the people take the body . Is it recording?
It's recording. But there's a gadget that detects your face, so there's a square box on the face. It's a new recording.
Oh, it's a new machine? Anyway, we'll have to continue. Okay, so this dog's ascetic, dog duty ascetic, he passes away on this, he gets indigestion, even though he's trying to be careful about his food, but on the seventh day he gets indigestion, and then he dies. Then the people throw his body into the charnel ground, and then Sunakata goes there, and he comes up to the body, he taps on it three times, and then the ascetic sort of regains consciousness, he looks up and says, "Can I help you?" And Sunakata says, "Where have you been reborn?" And the dog's ascetic says, "Oh, terrible place. I've been reborn. I've been reborn in this lowest grade of the asuras." And then he goes back, falls back, the body falls back, and then he's dead. But Sunakata still doesn't get the idea that this is a supernormal power that the Buddha has shown him. Okay, then, sometime later, he's still the attendant of the Buddha. They're going into the village on alms round, the city on alms round. And then they pass a certain ascetic who has made a vow. Well, this ascetic goes naked. He's made a vow to observe this practice of, you know, it's trying to keep the body as repulsive as possible by not bathing, not shaving, not grooming oneself, letting all of the dirt and mud accumulate on the body. And he's made the vow to observe, you know, strict celibacy, and to abstain from certain foods, only to eat a very limited kinds of number of foods, which are considered very rough and coarse food. And so as they pass this ascetic, Sunakata points him out and tells the Buddha about his extreme ascetic practices. Then the Buddha says to Sunakata, "Mark my word, before 7 days have passed, this ascetic will have renounced the life of renunciation. He will be well bathed, well shaved, he will have a wife. And he'll be eating all sorts of sumptuous food." Okay, so then time goes by, and then on the seventh day, they're going together into the village or town on alms round, and who do they meet along the way but that former ascetic who's now accompanied by his wife. He's well-bathed, well-groomed, and he's eating all varieties of sumptuous food. Okay, so sometime later, yeah, there's an ascetic living in a certain park. I think it must be around the area of Vaisali. And he gives out a challenge because the Buddha's reputation has spread. And so this ascetic is jealous of the Buddha. His name is Pratigaputta. He's the one who gives his name to the sutta. He gives out a challenge. He says, "The ascetic Gotama doesn't have any kind of supernormal powers, but I have supernormal powers. If the ascetic Gotama comes to me, if he displays one supernormal power, I'll display two. If he displays two supernormal powers, I'll display three or four. But I throw out the gauntlet, throw down the gauntlet. I give this challenge to the ascetic Gotama to come to me and join me in a contest of supernormal powers. Okay, then Sunakata hears about this challenge and he reports it to the Buddha. And the Buddha just says that the holy life is not lived under me for the sake of supernormal powers. But anyway, sometime the Buddha plans to go to the park of this ascetic Patika, the hermitage where he lives. And so he sort of gives out word of this, and word spreads and word comes to this ascetic Patika. The recluse Gotama, the Buddha, he's coming your way to spend some time at your park. When Patika hears this, he gets frightened and he leaves his own hermitage and he goes to some other hermitage. Okay, the Buddha arrives there and people are waiting for Patika to turn up for this contest of supernormal powers to take place. But then they hear that Patika isn't at the park, but he's gone elsewhere. And so they send a messenger to this place where Patika is staying, and the messenger tells him, Patika, the ascetic Gotama has come to your park. He's waiting for you to come there to join the contest of supernormal powers. And Patika is sitting in his seat, and he says, I'm coming, friend, I'm coming. But he's not able to get up from his seat. He just sits there wiggling, saying, I'm coming. I'm sorry. I'm coming, friend. I'm coming, friend. But he can't get up. Then more people come to find out what's going on. So a whole bunch of people comes and says, Patika, come! The ascetic Gotama is there waiting for you to join the contest of supernormal powers. He says, I'm coming, friends, I'm coming. But he can't get up from the seat. Then the whole assembly that's been gathered there all comes to Patika and says, Patika, come, come. And he just says, I'm coming, friends. I'm coming, friends. But he just wiggles in the seat, unable to get up. Okay, so that's... If you want to read it yourself, it's the Digha Nikaya Sutta. I think it's number 24. The first sutta in the third part of the long discourses. Okay, so... Usually comic relief, a comic break in the Shakespearean tragedies usually come in the middle of the play, not at the beginning. Okay, so, but this sutta apparently, I mean, obviously it takes place at a time when Sunakata was still a monk and a disciple of the Buddha. Okay, so at the time the sutta begins, a number of monks had been declaring what's here called final knowledge, which means arahatship. It's the same as arahatship. In the presence of the Buddha saying, then there's a stock formula for the declaration of arahatship. One understands that birth is destroyed, or in other words, that birth is, the round of rebirth is finished, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming back to any state of being. Okay, so then, you know, word about this spreads, and then so Sunakata hears about this, and he goes to the Buddha, and he says that he's heard this report, and then he asks the Buddha whether these monks who declared final knowledge did so correctly and rightly, or are there some cases where monks declare final knowledge because they overrate themselves or overestimate themselves. That is, they think they've reached the final goal, but they haven't. Excuse me, I seem to be getting some phlegm in my throat. So monks can overestimate themselves. I mean, there are various ways. And not only for arahatship, but one could overestimate oneself about many stages, whether it be jhana, insight knowledges, or any of the paths from stream entry up to arahatship. For example, there are some monks might achieve actually one of the jhanas, and then they take that to be an attainment of wisdom. And so they think that they've reached stream entry or even arhatship. Other monks get very deep insight knowledge and they take that to be the breakthrough to stream entry or one of the other attainments. Interesting question, whether one could achieve stream entry or once returning, and then mistakenly take that to be arahatship. But somehow I don't think that would be possible. I think one would one would know what stage one has reached. Okay, so then the Buddha replies to Sunakata. He says that when those monks declared final knowledge in my presence, there were some who declared final knowledge rightly, and there were some who declared final knowledge because they overestimated themselves. Okay, so then the Buddha then says, when there are monks who declare final knowledge rightly, then the Buddha will simply acknowledge their declaration. Or sometimes he'll ask them to maybe to recite a verse expressing their realization. But when they declare final knowledge because they overestimate themselves, that is because they wrongly judge their experience, then the Buddha thinks that I should teach them the Dhamma, and then he'll give them a teaching, which presumably has the purpose of revealing to them that they've not actually attained what they believe they've attained. But then the Buddha says, some misguided men here formulate a question and come to me and ask it. In that case, Sunakata, though the Tathagata has thought I should teach them the Dhamma, still I change. He changes his mind. And I have to say, the statement to myself, it doesn't seem to cohere very well with what just came previously. I would think what would be expected would be, okay, so there are monks who declare arhatship because they overestimate themselves. So that's a case where the monk is sincere and genuine, but just he misinterprets his meditative experience and thinks it's a realization. So what I would expect in the third place is those monks who come to the Buddha and declare arhatship, but do so knowing that it's false, in order to get maybe praise from the Buddha, congratulations, or maybe to get appointed to some high position in the Sangha. But then if they make a declaration, knowingly a declaration of arhatship that's false, that would be a transgression of one of the four gravest classes of transgressions, according to the monastic code. It's the class called parajika, which means defeaters or expulsion offenses, and that's the type of offenses that would negate one's status as a monk, so one would have to be asked to leave the Sangha. Anyway, in this case, monks come and they ask the question, but in this case, when they're coming to the Buddha and asking a question, they're not asking it because they really want to understand something, but maybe they're asking the question because, I don't know, they want to provoke the Buddha, or maybe to get praise from the Buddha for asking such an intelligent question. But they have some kind of suspect motivation, some kind of unwholesome motivation in asking the question. So in this case, the Buddha says that he changes his mind. Though I would expect that what the Buddha would do in such a situation would be that it's not that he completely gives up the idea of teaching the Dhamma, but rather, if he knows that this monk is susceptible, then he would give him an admonition or some kind of stern warning that he should examine his own mind, correct his way of thinking, and let himself, you know, apply himself diligently to the practice, and not just try to ask questions for the purpose of troubling the Buddha or just to, you know, just to engage in idle conversation or to try to win praise from the Buddha. Okay, so when the Buddha gives this statement to Sunakata, then Sunakata picks up on this and says, he makes a request to the Buddha to teach the Dhamma. Okay, now the Buddha is going to give a discourse. It's a kind of graded or sequential discourse on how monks who reach successively higher attainments lose interest in matters that pertain to lower or inferior levels of experience. So he begins with the five cords or five objects of sensual pleasure, that is, delightful and agreeable forms, sounds, odors, odors, tastes, and tactile sensations. Okay, so then the Buddha says that when there's some person here who may be intent on worldly material things. And the expression, the Pali expression that's used here, is an interesting one. It's loka misa. So the word loka means world, and then the word amisa means, at least one of its meanings, original meaning, is bait. The bait that a fisherman uses to catch fish. It's like a little piece of meat that the fisherman puts onto the hook and throws out into the water to catch fish. And so the things of the world, the delightful and agreeable things of the world, come to be called lokamisa, because these function as the bait that keeps worldly people attached to the enjoyment of the world. Okay, so when a person is intent on worldly, material things, then only talk concerning this interests him, and his thinking and pondering are in line with that. And here the words translated as thinking and pondering are vitakka and vichara, for those who came to the Abhidhamma retreat last week. So these are in this thinking and pondering. Vitakka, it's the mental factors of vitakka and vichara that play the prominent role. So you could see vitakka and vichara, they can function in worldly thinking, and also then they become the factors that operate still in the first jhana. So his thinking and pondering are in line with that, and he associates with that kind of person, you know, with the kind of person who's also intent on worldly enjoyments. And he finds satisfaction in that. If you just consider most ordinary people out in the world, like on a Saturday morning, there's probably, I don't know, did the football season start yet?
Yes.
They have football games on TV?
Yep.
Maybe that's why there aren't so many people sitting.
It's more because of tennis.
Yeah, it's the tennis.
Tennis.
It's
tennis.
The last 2 days of the year.
The World Cup?
US Open.
Oh, they call it US Open.
Yes.
Not the World Cup.
That's soccer.
That's soccer. Okay, so people, when there's a choice between Dhamma class and US Opens, US or World Opens?
U.S.
Opens, and
Serena and Venus.
Serena Williams.
Two players. They're very famous.
Yeah, I know of Serena Williams.
There you go. They're playing.
Okay.
Yes, so
let's go to the TV room. And then there's a website, called Huffington Post.
Yeah.
On the right-hand column, on the left-hand column, there are blogs about current events, different problems in the world. Usually the headline is about that. The middle column is sort of miscellaneous, a mixture of both reports on current events, personal opinion, as well as sort of popular and sometimes articles about scandals and so on. But the right-hand column is all about Hollywood gossip, TV gossip, and so on and so on, and sometimes strange and scandalous events. So somebody who is being described like this, when they go onto Huffington Post, their eyes will go immediately to the right-hand column. And then, he associates with that kind of person, so those kind of people associate together. They all will go to the same kinds of movies, the same kind of concerts. Like if there's a Rolling Stones concert, No, I love the Rolling Stones also. I'm only teasing Dean. Okay, but when talk about the imperturbable is going on, he will not listen to it or give it ear to it or exert his mind to understand it. He doesn't associate with those kinds of people, and he does not find satisfaction in that. Okay, so what's meant by the imperturbable here? Usually in the suttas, the word imperturbable refers to the formless meditative attainments, the arupa attainments, the immaterial attainments. But it's a little bit puzzling that here there's no mention, and I think the classical way that the commentaries explain the imperturbable, they explain it as the fourth jhana and the four formless attainments. Because it said in the formulas for the jhanas, it said that when one reaches the fourth jhana, for example, let's skip a page. Yeah, like on page 276, in paragraph 23, at the very beginning, when the Buddha is describing the state of mind of one who has reached the fourth jhana, he says that when his concentrated mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection or corruptions, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability. And so imperturbability thus becomes associated with the fourth jhana and then with the higher meditations, the formless meditations. But it's a little puzzling to me that in the sutta, the jhanas are not mentioned. So I'm just wondering if it's possible that maybe in this sutta, the word imperturbable has a broader meaning. This is just my speculation, even though it would go against the commentary, which would identify the imperturbable with the fourth jhana and higher. But because the jhanas are not mentioned, maybe we could also include them sort of temporarily or tentatively in the imperturbable. But to be on the safe side, take it to refer to the fourth jhana and the higher meditations. Okay, so then the Buddha illustrates this kind of interest with that of a man who had left his own native village a long time ago. Then, while he's away, he meets another man who had only recently left that village or town. And so then he would ask the person that he meets about the people in the town and village and so on and so on, and the man would explain to him. And as this man who's been away a long time listens, then he would be very intent on taking in the information, very keen to know what's going on in his native village. Maybe, for example, if Venerable Subodha here meets somebody from Wattala,
yeah.
Meets somebody at Chwangyan Monastery, some Sri Lankan people from Wattala, then they'll discuss what's going on in Wattala these days, and he's very interested. Or Suki is from, you're from Seoul? Or a small village?
Small village.
So if you meet somebody from Korea and you're saying, oh, you're from South Korea, where are you from? Then they say they're from the same village, then you're probably interested to know what's going on.
Yes.
If I meet somebody from Brooklyn, Brooklyn's too big. Borough Park, yeah. But I don't know anybody from Borough Park anymore, so. Okay, so in the same way, when somebody is intent on worldly things, then he's completely interested in talk about worldly things. Okay, so now we have somebody here who is said to be intent on the imperturbable. And so when this person is intent on the imperturbable, only talk about that is of interest to him. And when talk about material things is going on, then he's not interested, he doesn't want to listen, and he does not associate with people involved in worldly things, and does not find satisfaction. So the Buddha illustrates this with the example of a leaf, a yellow leaf, that has fallen from its stalk, and so it's incapable of being joined with the stalk again and turning green. And so then the Buddha says, this is the case that when a person is intent on the imperturbable, then he has shed the fetter of worldly material things. He's become detached from that fetter, and he is intent on the imperturbable. Okay, now we take it one step higher. Now, as you probably know, because we've gone through this quite a few times already, there are the four levels of formless meditations: the base of infinite space, the base of infinite consciousness, the base of nothingness, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And so now the Buddha is going to go within the range of the imperturbable, but go jump up to the third level, to the base of nothingness. And so now he's going to speak as though the imperturbable applies only to the lower two levels, or maybe the lower three if we count the fourth jhana. So he speaks about a person now who may have mastered the base of infinite space and the base of infinite consciousness. And now this meditator wants to go further to the base of nothingness. And so this is being described as a person who is intent on the base of nothingness. And so when a person is so intent, then only talk about this interests him, his thought is in line with that. He associates with that kind of person, maybe with a person who's already attained the base of nothingness, or with a fellow meditator who's also striving for it. And he finds satisfaction in that. So this becomes the sort of dominant idea, sort of the nucleus or core of his life, the prospect of attaining the base of nothingness. So we could see the way, you know, when there's a core interest which galvanizes people, it draws them together into groups that associate together. We even see this on the internet, you know, even with the Buddhist websites. There used to be one website called eSangha, which I think was established in Singapore, and then it used to have different divisions. There was one general Dhamma discussion division. Then there was a Theravada discussion group, a Mahayana, mainstream Mahayana discussion group, a Vajrayana discussion group. But then they split off. It seems eSangha website closed down, and it split off into different discussion groups. And so some people interested in early Buddhism were the Theravada tradition, gravitate to the Theravada discussion website. And even some in that website sort of split off so that they have suttas only website discussion group. Then there's a group that's very interested in the Abhidhamma. They've split off, and I think they have like Abhidhamma discussion group. Then there's the mainstream discussion group. Then within the Mahayana discussion group, I think one group is split off to the Zen discussion group, another group split off to the Pure Land discussion group, while others remain in the mainstream discussion group. Then probably the Vajrayana has maybe split off into the yellow sect, Gelugpa and Nyingma and Kargyupa and Sakyapa. So people sort of group together because of a common element. Okay, so now then the Buddha uses another simile to illustrate this. And this is a thick stone that's been split in two so that they can't be joined again. And so when a person is intent on the base of nothingness, then his fetter of the imperturbable has been split. That is, his interest, his inclination, simply towards the lower levels of the formless attainments has faded away. And so now he's galvanized by the idea of reaching the base of nothingness. Okay, now when people have attained and mastered the base of nothingness, then they might set their, what is the expression? Set their sight on the higher attainment that lies ahead. And remember, these are attainments still in this, all in this, I call it the ladder of samadhi, the ladder of mental concentration, the scale of mental concentration. We've not yet come to the practice for wisdom of insight, the practice of insight. But now somebody is going for the highest attainment along the scale or ladder of the arupa attainments, the formless meditations. That's the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And so when he's aiming for that attainment, then that is what grips his mind. And it's discussion about that which interests him. He thinks about that and he associates with people who have attained it or those who are likewise intent on attaining it. And so now, when discussion about the base of nothingness is going on, he's not even interested in it. Okay, then the Buddha compares this to a person, it's a rather striking simile, a person who has eaten some delicious food and then he has vomited it up. And the Buddha raises the question, would that man have any desire to eat that food again? So this was the maybe prime ribs of beef accompanied by sautéed potatoes and whatever, the most delicious fruits, mango, papaya, strawberries for dessert with couple of scoops of ice cream, a slice of cherry pie, all of it, you know, when you see it laid out on the table, so delicious, one wants to eat it. Of course, if one's vegetarian, maybe let's say some deliciously prepared vegetarian duck. Vegetarian pork, but prepared very nicely. And so one eats it, but then one gets indigestion and throws up, and then nobody can persuade one to eat it again. Okay, but actually those who attain the base of nothingness will still continue to attain it, but when they're aiming for the base of neither perception nor non-perception, then it's no longer of great interest to them. Okay, so the Buddha then says, when a person is intent on the base of neither perception nor non-perception, his fetter of the base of nothingness has been rejected. And so he should be understood as one detached from the fetter of the base of nothingness, who's intent on the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Okay, now we come to the next passage, which is concerned. Now, you see those attainments along the scale of the imperturbable, the formless meditations, are not really sort of the core or essence of the Buddha's teaching, but those are just vistas, so to speak, or landscapes that open up to those who are able to master samadhi. And so the Buddha includes these meditative attainments within his system of practice because he himself had gone through them before his enlightenment, and so they were known to the meditators of that period, whether Buddhist or non-Buddhist, and also because the Buddha, for the sake of completeness, wants to include all possible attainments within the sphere of samadhi into the scope of his teaching. But now the next section opens up the practice aimed at the ultimate goal of the Buddha's teaching. So here we have a person who is described as one completely intent on Nibbana. And so when a person is completely intent on Nibbana, only talk about that interests him. He is constantly thinking about that. He associates with others who have either attained it or are more advanced along the way to Nibbana. And he finds satisfaction in that. And so when discussions about the base of neither perception nor non-perception are going on, then he's not so intently interested in that. Then the Buddha compares this to a palm tree with the top cut off. And so that palm tree, when the top is cut off, it's incapable of growing again. And so when a person is completely intent on Nibbana, then it's said that his fetter of the base of neither perception nor non-perception has been cut off at the root, and so on, no longer subject to future arising. So this should be understood as one detached from the fetter of the base of neither perception nor non-perception, who is completely intent on Nibbana. And this has to be taken again a little bit with some reservations. It doesn't mean that the person who is intent on Nibbana will not enter the base of neither perception nor non-perception. For example, Venerable Sariputta, when he was training for the attainment of arhatship, he actually entered the base of neither perception nor non-perception and used it as a vehicle for insight in order to reach arhatship. And others who are practicing for arhatship, who are able to reach the base of neither perception nor non-perception, may still enter it from time to time, either to make the mind just very, very calm in order to develop insight, or else to use that base itself as the object of contemplation for gaining insight. But what one would say is that when the person makes the attainment of Nibbana his goal, then the base of neither perception nor non-perception no longer becomes, you could say, the pole star of his life, you know, that around which all of his activities revolve, that at which he is aiming with all his heart and soul. Okay, now comes The Buddha is going to move off from this to another theme, I mean, related to it. And I have to say that from paragraph 18 on, the texts, all of the texts that I consulted when doing this translation, the Burmese Sixth Council edition, the singular script Buddha Jayanti edition, and the Pali Text Society edition, all have certain differences in their readings. And so even to do the translation, I had to choose from the three texts that I looked at which reading seemed to me to be the best, to make the best sense, and none of them was consistently good. So the readings that I chose, sometimes I would take the Burmese reading over the other two, sometimes the Sri Lankan reading over the other two, I think sometimes the PTS reading over the other two. Okay, so now the Buddha says it's possible that some bhikkhu here might think craving has been called an arrow by the recluse, by the samana. And here the samana that's being spoken about is the Buddha. Okay, so this is supposed to be this. So he's continuing. Craving has been called an arrow by the Buddha, and the poisonous humor of ignorance is spread about by desire, lust, and ill will. And here, I just write the Pali of this on the board. Avijja is ignorance. The word visa means poison. And then the word dosa here, it doesn't mean dosa. It's not the word dosa meaning hatred, but it's another word, dosa, in Pali, which sometimes it means fault, but in physiology, in Indian physiology, it means it's a kind of humor of the body. Like they speak about the three doshas, the three humors, three kinds of substances in the body that account for the condition of the body. I think it's phlegm, bile, and wind.
The gunas?
They're not the same as the gunas of Indian thought, of the Sankhya system, Sankhya yoga system. Though the three humors are used in Ayurvedic medicine as a basis for diagnosis and prescription. Okay, but then there are certain doses, I guess, in the body which are considered poisonous. So it's like, you know, an infection will create a poisonous dosa, a snake bite, some illness. So it's ignorance is spoken of as the poisonous humor, and then it's said to be agitated or disturbed or here spread about by chanda, which is desire, and raga. Chanda, raga go together to mean like passionate desire. And vyapada is ill will, anger or hatred. Okay, so this monk thinks that arrow of craving has been removed from me. The poisonous humor of ignorance has been expelled. I am one who is completely intent on Nibbana. Do you think this monk understands his situation correctly? How does it seem? He says, or he thinks to himself, the arrow of craving has been removed. The poisonous humor of ignorance has been expelled. I am one who is completely intent on Nibbana. You have some thought. Yes.
The sentence is, I am one, so there is conceit.
Oh, that might be the case too. But suppose he was thinking, I am just simply, I am completely intent on Nibbana. There'd still be a mistake, even if he were thinking in that way.
Is he overestimating his progress?
How do we know that?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Because he hasn't talked about the other states. That's the fourth jhana, right?
No, we don't have to bring that in.
He's not being specific about removing ill will. Well, I mean, I've seen them combined up here, but I think of the states as three states, and he's saying he's beyond two of them.
That's a good point, but it wasn't what I had in mind. Because I would think if he gets rid of ignorance and chandaraga, passionate desire, one would assume that ill will would go along with it, even though that's not mentioned. Osman?
Is he mistaken the jhanas where craving and ignorance is subdued as being removed?
I think you're on the right track. Okay, the point that I made, that struck me, is okay. He thinks that ignorance and craving are removed, and then he says, "I'm completely intent on Nibbana." But if he had really just removed craving and expelled ignorance, then he would not say, I'm intent on Nibbana, but he'd say, I have Nibbana Patto, I've attained Nibbana. So that strikes me as somewhat contradictory, to say, I've gotten rid of ignorance and craving, and now I'm really intent on Nibbana. Okay, anyway, the text, and then this is translated on the basis of the way I construed it from the different readings. Since he conceives himself thus, though it is contrary to fact, he might pursue those things that are unsuitable for one completely intent on Nibbana. And what is unsuitable would be the sight of unsuitable forms, unsuitable sounds, unsuitable odors, tastes, tactile objects and ideas. In other words, he indulges in sense pleasures and unwholesome thoughts, thinking that he's free from ignorance and craving and so that he can indulge in them. And then as he does so, then lust invades his mind, and with lust invading his mind, he would incur death or deadly suffering, then does the sutta say what death or deadly suffering is? Wow, it seems it doesn't say that, but it's said that in other suttas that what is death or deadly suffering in the it's called in the good Dhamma, in the noble Dhamma, is that one gives up the renunciate life or one commits the very serious transgression of the precepts. Okay, now the Buddha is going to use some similes here. And again, there was some ambiguity among the different readings about how we should construe the similes. But the way it's rendered here makes good sense, at least to me. Okay, suppose there's a man who's wounded by an arrow, thickly smeared with poison. Then his friends and relatives and so forth bring a surgeon. And the surgeon cuts around the opening of the wound with a knife, probes for the arrow, and then he pulls out the arrow and he expels the poisonous humor, but he leaves a trace of it behind unknowingly. So the surgeon thinks that there's no trace left behind, and he says to the man that the arrow has been pulled out, the humerus, the poison, is expelled with no trace left behind. It's incapable of harming you. Eat only suitable food, nothing unsuitable, or else the wound may suppurate. That means pus may form. From time to time, you should wash the wound. From time to time, anoint the opening, so that pus and blood don't cover the opening of the wound. Do not walk around in the wind and sun, or else dust and dirt may get into the opening and infect it. Take care of your wound, good man, and see to it that the wound heals. Okay, then the man thinks the arrow has been pulled out. The poisonous humor has been expelled with no trace left behind, and it is incapable of harming me. And so then he takes it easy, so he eats unsuitable food, and then the wound would suppurate. He doesn't wash the wound, and he doesn't anoint the opening of the wound with medicine from time to time. And so pus and blood would cover the opening. He goes around in the wind and sun, and the dust and dirt get into the opening and infect the wound. And so he would not take care of his wound, nor would he see to it that the wound heals. Then, because he does what is unsuitable, and because a trace was left behind, the wound would swell. And as it swells, then it gets more infected, and the poisonous humor forms again. And so then he incurs death or deadly suffering. Okay, so that's one case. Now we come to the case. Here it is possible that some monk might think, again, craving has been called an arrow by the recluse and so on. I am one who is completely intent upon Nibbana. Oh, this is just repeating the previous passage. So he thinks, I am one who is completely intent upon Nibbana. Because he conceives himself thus, though it is contrary to fact, again he pursues those things that are unsuitable and so forth, and then with his mind invaded by lust, he would incur death or deadly suffering. Then here comes the statement that it is death in the discipline of the noble one when one abandons the training and reverts to the lower life, this is to the worldly life, and it is deadly suffering when one commits some defiled offense, that is some major transgression. Okay, now we have the contrary case where the monk might think that craving has been called an arrow by the recluse, the poisonous humor of ignorance is spread by desire, lust, and ill will. The arrow of craving has been removed from me. The poisonous humor of ignorance has been expelled. I am one who is completely intent on Nibbana. Again, this is supposed to be the bright side of the teaching. Again, it's a bit of a puzzle that the monk who's really intent on the training and who's going to train himself properly consider himself completely intent on Nibbana. And then he also thinks that craving has been removed and ignorance has been expelled. I don't have an explanation for this. Maybe somebody here can figure it out. Okay, so being one who is really completely intent on Nibbana, he doesn't pursue those things that are unsuitable for one completely intent on Nibbana. That is, he doesn't pursue unsuitable forms, sounds, odors, and so forth. And because he does not pursue those things, so lust or passion doesn't invade his mind. And because his mind is not invaded by lust, he would not incur death or deadly suffering. So this is the monk who is truly and sincerely dedicated to the training. He's not yet attained Nibbana. He's intent on reaching Nibbana. But somehow it says that he thinks he's removed craving and expelled ignorance. Okay, anyway, continuing. So now we have the converse side of the simile. So we have a man who is wounded by an arrow thickly smeared with poison. Then his relatives bring the surgeon. The surgeon performs the operation, pulls out the arrow, expels the poisonous humor without leaving a trace of it behind. And then knowing that no trace was left behind, he says the arrow has been expelled, has been pulled out, the poison has been expelled with no trace left behind. It's incapable of harming you. Eat only suitable food, wash the wound, do not go out in the wind and sun. Take care of your wound and see to it that the wound heals. Okay, so the man reflects on the advice of the physician. So he eats only suitable food and the wound doesn't suppurate. He washes the wound and anoints it, and so pus and blood don't cover the opening. He doesn't go out in the wind and sun, and so dust and dirt don't get into the opening and cause an infection. So he takes care of the wound, and the wound heals. And so, because he takes care of himself in this way, he would not incur death or deadly suffering. And so then, well, the next paragraph simply applies the simile to the case of the monk who doesn't engage or indulge in the unsuitable objects of the senses or unsuitable thought. And so, since he does not incur death or deadly suffering, this would mean that, okay, he doesn't depart from the training, he doesn't abandon the training to revert to the household life, and he does not commit some major transgression, the defiled offense. But it doesn't say anything yet about his attainments. It's still that he is, we say that this is still the monk in training, one who is striving to reach Nibbana. And so the application of a simile is a little bit, again, it's a little bit puzzling. It doesn't seem to square 100%. So, here, this is paragraph 27. I have given this simile in order to convey a meaning. This is the meaning. Wound is a term for the six internal sense bases. The poisonous humor is a term for ignorance. The arrow is a term for craving. The probe, a term for mindfulness. The knife is a term for noble wisdom. And the surgeon is the Tathagata, that's the Buddha, the fully enlightened one. So if we apply that to this, we apply the simile to the case, okay, the simile, the surgeon takes out the arrow. Now the arrow is a term for craving, and the surgeon expels the poisonous humor, which is ignorance. And so if we have, say, the Buddha giving the advice to the monk, and through his advice, the Buddha is taking out craving and ignorance. Then it would seem, why is the monk still just one intent on Nibbana? He's not yet declared to be an arhat. What do you think? If you have any ideas, don't take the microphone. I mean, I don't have the solution myself. Be the case. Maybe, in fact, maybe that monk is an arahat, even though it's not being stated so explicitly. But Michael?
I'm a bit troubled by the idea of the Tathagata leaving a trace as though somehow he had made a mistake, which is not the case.
No, it's not. Okay, go on.
Well, I was going to say the analogy between the search and the surgeon being the Buddha. So, therefore, it seems as though if a trace of ignorance is left, then, and on the one hand, and the laxity, the laziness, the laxity of the disciple, well, I don't have to take care of this, is another way of saying ignorance, because that's a very ignorant thing to do in a spiritual sense. So therefore, it's as though these two things are almost the same. Or to put it another way, if there's a trace of ignorance left, then naturally we won't take care of what needs to be taken care of. That's the expression of ignorance. Whereas if there's no trace of ignorance, then it follows naturally that we don't really, how can I put this, that we're going to take care of it because
Yeah.
We're free of ignorance. So it isn't as though, I mean, I'm not entirely disagreeing with what Suki said, but I think the relationship is causal and more closely tied.
First, I would think that in the case where the surgeon is one, if the reading is correct that there is a trace left behind, then maybe that surgeon is not being the one who's being considered analogous to the Buddha, but rather, because the text would not show the Buddha as being responsible for a careless fault, but it would be the surgeon who takes out the arrow without a trace behind and then gives the proper advice. That would always be compared to the Buddha. Joan?
I have a short question.
Yeah.
The trace, can that trace be like an asana? Or, I mean, that doesn't seem the trace is the same as ignorance.
If the asavas are removed, if ignorance and craving are removed, the asavas are removed, and so there would be, you know, even the idea of what the trace is a little bit of a puzzle. Joan, who is sitting?
Thank you. There's the probe that's mentioned.
The what?
The probe.
Yeah.
And the probe is mindfulness.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if that's the tool that the surgeon used.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if the bhikkhu had to continue with his mindfulness, because that's the tool to...
Of course, if he hasn't yet... Yeah, of course, if he hasn't really completed the practice, then he needs to use mindfulness.
Right, so it's not only the Tathagata, but it's also the bhikkhu that has to keep it going on his own.
Yeah, actually, I think, you know, the simile or the analogy isn't so exact, because in the analogy, the surgeon does all the work and the patient is just lying there. In modern medicine, the patient will be under an anesthetic, so he doesn't even know what's going on. But maybe what's meant by the Buddha performing the operation is that the Buddha gives the patient the tools to treat himself, just like the Buddha gives us, you know, mindfulness and wisdom. What are the ones mentioned here? Mindfulness and noble wisdom to take out the poison and the arrow and poison from ourselves. Anyway, let us go on, because there's just 5 minutes and I want to finish the sutta. Okay, so now the Buddha continues. He says, that bhikkhu, that monk, is one who practices restraint in the 6 bases of contact. And so this seems to suggest that he's still in training, not yet finished, not yet fully, you know, fully enlightened. And so now this shows his attainment of arhatship. The next few sentences. Having understood that acquisition here is upaddhi, is the root of suffering, being without acquisitions, liberated in the destruction of the acquisitions. It is not possible that he would direct his body or rouse his mind towards any acquisition. And here the word upaddhi, translated acquisition, it has a number of shades of meaning, or a number of reference. One is the defilements, and the other are objects of attachment. So the inner defilements and the objects of attachment, including the 5 aggregates themselves, as well as outer objects, sense pleasures or commodities that give worldly pleasure. And so when one is liberated through the destruction of the acquisitions, that would be probably the destruction of the inner defilements, then it's not possible that he would direct his body or arouse his mind towards any external objects of attachment. Then we have another simile, that suppose there's a bronze cup with a beverage with a nice color, smell, and taste, but it's mixed with poison, and a man comes along who wants to live and not to die, who wants pleasure and is averse to pain. So would that man, knowing that there's poison in it, drink that beverage, aware that if he were to drink the beverage, he might die or incur deadly suffering? And so he wouldn't direct his body, he wouldn't drink of that poison beverage. And so in the same way, the monk who now is liberated through the destruction of the upadhi, of the defilements, wouldn't direct his body or mind towards any objects of attachment. Again, suppose there were a poisonous snake and a man comes who wants to live. And so would that man give his hand or his thumb to that deadly poisonous snake to bite, and knowing that he would die if he gets bitten? And so Sunakata says no. And so similarly, when a monk is practicing restraint in the senses and so on, liberated by the destruction of, still have the old rendering here, not yet corrected. Well, is without acquisition, here we should read, is without acquisition, liberated by the destruction of acquisitions, it's not possible that he would direct his body or arouse his mind towards any objects of acquisition. Okay, this is a sutta, and since it's 11:30, I'm sorry we don't have time for questions now, but if you stay through the lunch period, then we'll have a discussion from 11:15. So if you have any questions, comments, solutions to some of the problems, we could discuss them then. Okay, so let us end with the sharing of the merits. I'll do it in the short form. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantam Anumodipa Chirang Rakantu Mang Param Eta Vatacham Hehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabbe Devanumodantu Sabba Sampati Siddhya Sabbe Bhutanumodantu Sabba Sampati Siddhya Sabbe Satanumodantu Sabba Sampati Siddhya Bhava Gopadaya Vichihe Tato Etantare Satakai Upapanna Rupiya Rupicha Sanya Sanino Dukkha Pumuchantu Pusantu Nibhutin. Yeah, and I should mention now that next week we won't have a class on Saturday, so the next class will be on September 21st. And then we'll take the Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 108. This is the Gopika Moggallana Sutta. Okay, we could stand up for the closing three bells.